From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationships with it. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley. Now, our first guest this morning is Sarah Jo Dickin, who is the owner of the environmental consulting firm Ecology Bridge and is also with the CWMA project. And she's the project manager there. And we're going to learn what that is in just a moment. Sarah Jo Dickin is live in our studio talking about noxious weeds and how we can be weed warriors.
That's in the first part of the show. Then in the second part, we'll talk about the Earth's rotation on its axis once every 24 hours, right? And how that varies slightly from time to time. Now, with the planet warming, that rotation is literally shifting the weight of the planet away from the poles, which in turn is slowing its rotation. And that could present a problem for global timekeeping, according to a paper published in the March 2024 issue of Nature by Duncan Agnew, a geophysicist at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. We'll speak with Duncan about this phenomenon and its potential consequences to timekeeping worldwide, and more importantly, computer systems, all of that in the second half of the show. Environmental awareness and education, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
And you are listening to This Green Earth. I'm Claire Wiley.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And here now in the studio, which we love having guests live in the studio, we have Sarah Jo Dickin, and she is with Ecology Bridge and is also the CWMA project manager. So welcome, Sarah Jo.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, we're so glad to have you here with us today, and we have a lot to talk about when it comes to noxious weeds, and you're going to explain all that to us as we head into this planting season and into spring. But first of all, let's get a little background on you, Sarah Jo, and more about Ecology Bridge and what CWMA project is.
So Ecology Bridge is a local environmental consulting firm, and we work with several government agencies, as well as local landowners, so both public and private. And we're contracted by the Summit CWMA through Summit County in order to assist people in understanding what noxious weeds are and control them and restore the environments that have been impacted. And so the Summit CWMA is a cooperative weed management area. It's now officially a nonprofit. This will be the first year we're a nonprofit. And it's really a collection of our local government, our state government, our resorts, local businesses, a lot of HOAs, and then a lot of independent residents that just really care about their environment, understand that noxious weeds have drastic impacts, and that controlling noxious weeds alone is only one step, and that restoration is the ultimate goal.
And so let's get into a little bit of definitions about a noxious weed, what it is, what it isn't, and why we should care about this.
Mm-hmm. So a weed is just a plant. We call it a plant out of place. It's a plant someone doesn't want somewhere. Dandelions, often considered weeds, because people would like their turf grass to be nice and green, monocultures, right? But a noxious weed is something that is different in the sense that it is categorized by the state of Utah, or actually your local government can deem a couple of noxious weeds as well. And these particular species are, they're put on the list because they have the substantial potential to significantly impact our economy. Usually we're talking about agriculture, but more and more we're talking about recreational experience, as well as substantially impact our natural resources, so water conservation, wildfire, erosion, and then health and safety. There are some plants that can send you to the hospital, and so, or poison livestock, or your damage or injure your animals. So we will see those put on the list only if it's a significant potential for that to occur.
So law defined, how many species are currently on this list?
Currently, there are 54 species listed in Utah, and we're about to add two more to that list and potentially a couple additional ones after that. That's still being discussed at the state level with several ecologists and natural resource folks
The two that are being added will be our first true aquatic weeds. Some people already know that Phragmites is a noxious weed, and it's been on the list for years. You do find it in ponds and streams, but you can find it in ditchways. You can find it in parking lots. And in a sense, it's aquatic because it can grow and often does in water, and you need to treat it as if it's aquatic when we're talking about herbicide use. Mm-hmm. But these other two species are submerged. They actually grow up or grow from the top of the water surface down into the water column. Hmm. And so those two are Eurasian milfoil. So anyone from the Midwest, you know it well. We've been scrubbing it out of boats for years. And then something called parrot feather, which a lot of folks are just not very aware of at this point, including most of us folks here in Utah that control weeds.
Okay, so that's the current list. Are all these species, these 54 and perhaps soon to be 56, are they native to the state or are they non-native in a sense they were brought here?
All of them are not native. So many of them came either accidentally, sometimes in seed mix for forage. Some of them came on purpose because like garlic mustard, it can taste great. There are some things that are herbs that were planted for a food source. Mm. And so they came over and then they escaped those gardens and became problematic. And so generally native plants, they have their natural enemies. They have fungus, they have all sorts of different diseases and herbivores that will keep them in check. Non-native plants that came over that don't have those enemies, they didn't come with them. They have nothing stopping them from taking over. And so we call that the enemy release theory. And it's the idea that any of these invasive plants that came over without something to control them has a better chance of competing with those that already have something here keeping them in check.
So we're not crazy when we think that there are a lot more weeds than there are the plants that we actually want out there.
Totally, yeah.
Wow, okay. That's interesting. And so when a non-native plant comes in here, do they ever not survive? Or are there some that actually are eradicated because we don't have a friendly environment for them? Or are we just nurturing all these noxious weeds?
There are definitely plants that come over and don't do well. Many of them might establish somewhere, but just for whatever reason, whether it's climate, soils, and sometimes they're close enough related to another species that's native, that you may find that something will eat it here, right? And so it will be kept in check. And so there's certainly plants that come over that will never be problematic. And there are certain times too that we'll find with some of our noxious weeds that we stop controlling them at different locations because we've introduced biological controls. And those are enemies that have been tested for years before we use them, and we release them to help us to control these plants. And we have a couple locations now that those are so effective, we only check to make sure they're keeping it in check. We no longer have to control those areas.
Okay, what are those enemies? You mean bugs?
Bugs mostly.
Parasites? Okay.
Yeah, so a lot of them are beetles. Okay. Some of them are flies. I think the beetles, the weevils, are absolutely adorable. If you ever get a chance to go out in the field with us or with Dave Bingham and check them out, they really are adorable. There are also funguses, and we're way more careful with the distribution of fungi because, you know, they can spread in a way that insects aren't going to. And so we're definitely more careful with that. And I think currently, the only one that's being used might be a Canada thistle fungus that actually really has a hard time establishing. When it does establish, it's effective, but it's really just very difficult to get it to establish.
And the reasoning behind this is to avoid insecticides or pesticides?
It is. It's one way for us to reduce the use of herbicides. It's also a way of... Well, so an herbicide is a pesticide.
Yeah.
So so you're totally correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Great.
But it's also about safety in some ways and logistics, because when we have very large populations in the backcountry, the cost of getting people there to continually treat these areas can be just overwhelming. And if it takes the whole budget and we can't address all the other locations, it's pretty problematic. And so if we can use a biocontrol to reduce the number of times we have to go out there and to keep it from the weed from spreading, that's one benefit. And so that's really financial, right? The other is safety. I mean, think about trying to walk on some of these ski slopes in the summer. They're rocky, they're steep, they're dangerous. Now put a heavy backpack with a fluid in it on your back and try and walk up these hills. And so when we have large populations on ski slopes, the releasing of these biocontrols allows us to limit the number of times these folks have to be out there, sort of putting their safety at risk in order to control these weeds.
But are these biocontrols species specific, or can they be more broad in nature, you know, and maybe kill multiple weeds, but put other native plants at risk? I mean, you're always playing that, you're trying to do that calculus.
Kind of playing a game, right? And in the beginning, before we knew more, there were certainly a couple species that were released that did change their host, and it was problematic. And so we learned from our mistakes, and now APHIS is the agency that oversees these decisions, and the testing goes for 20, 50 years. We've been waiting for a garlic mustard control, biocontrol, for like 25 years. And every year we hear it's 2 to 5 years out, but they're not just going to release it without the test. And so most of these species are, the biocontrol species are specific, generally species specific. However, there are a couple, like for those used for knapweed or some of the toad flaxes, they're close enough related, the plants themselves, that the biocontrols will also eat them. However, even when, say, I have a biocontrol for spotted knapweed, if I release it for Russian knapweed or diffuse knapweed, they're generally not as effective, but they will eat those plants. But before the biocontrols are released, they're tested on so many different species. Mm-hmm. They're tested on anything closely related that's native, anything that goes into agricultural production in the United States. And they do what's called starvation tests. They put them in there with no other option. And if they don't eat what's in there and choose to starve to death instead, then we know they're not going to move on to another species, most likely.
And what have you seen any effects for that ecosystem, how that's changed with birds or other animals that might be predators to them?
It's a good question. I don't know that there's much research on how much predation there is with birds and even mammals and lizards, right, on these. But we certainly do. One thing we do know that is occurring, ants do very well in areas of certain biocontrols. They will grab those little guys up pretty quickly. And we no longer release biocontrols in certain areas that we know are dry and have high ant populations because they will drag them away and we'll lose the biocontrols. But we have, somebody else just asked me that question recently, and I need to do a little bit of digging to see if there's any potential negative consequences. As far as I know, none of these are toxic. So birds should be able to safely consume them.
I just wonder if that means that there might be more birds in that area because they're attracted to that. And then what does that mean for the ecosystem overall? It's just interesting how when we start to, it feels like a better option, but then when we start to play with this, how we might be changing the ecosystem entirely.
I agree. I think it's a great point to make. And I think that it's always about determining what is the most, the reduced impact that we can have that might be negative, while at the same time having the most beneficial impact. And if we think about spraying herbicide and how that might clear a complete area and create bare ground versus releasing a beetle that is going to slowly kill those plants and allow for natives to move back in, maybe that's the better approach for the whole ecosystem. But again, it's a network. And we never know what pulling on one little string of that web is doing somewhere else. We just have to pay attention the best we can.
We're speaking with Sarah Jo Dicken. She's the plant ecologist and owner of the consulting firm Ecology Bridge, and also the project manager for the Summit CWMA. Let's now turn our attention to one noxious weed in particular, garlic mustard. What is it? What does it look like? Why is it a problem? What are we doing about it?
So garlic mustard, it gets the most attention in Summit County. And that's just because it isn't very common in the state. It's currently known to be present in maybe 6 or 7 counties. In Summit County, however, we have over 700 acres, and that is mostly on the western side of the county. This particular species, like many noxious weeds, puts out a lot of seeds that can last a long time, germinates really fast, grows fast, and outcompetes our natives. So readily displaces. So outcompeting, totally replacing the natives, maybe even becoming a monoculture. That simple step in what it does impacts habitat quality, right? So we don't have forage for our big game. We don't even have forage for small mammals. They don't really want to eat it. Insects won't eat it.
So bees stay, pollinators stay away.
Pollinators don't really utilize it. Every year we'll see a couple of little like bites on a few leaves, and you can tell that they decided that was nasty. I'm out of here. Right. And then we just don't really see insects hanging out on it. And so it doesn't really provide any benefit. And so that's what a lot of the impact of a lot of noxious weeds is generally. But garlic mustard is part of a group of weeds that also do more. They put chemicals in the soil called allelopathy. So this process, the plant will put the chemical in the soil and it'll either impact the soil somehow, changing nutrient levels or the microbial community, or it can just simply suppress germination of other plants. And that is what garlic mustard does. It suppresses germination of all other plants. So it makes a habitat that's better for its own growth because it doesn't have competition. And then on top of that, plants generally have relationships with the soil microbes. That's how they can get access to water. That's how some nutrients are broken down and made available. Garlic mustard, like many of the brassicas or the mustards, often don't have relationships with fungus. And that's important here because our forests rely heavily on soil fungi. Mycorrhizal associations, as we often call it, is the way that a lot of our trees, especially our conifer trees, our evergreens, are accessing water during drought. And if you've done any kind of research or listened to people talk about wildfire, when we're talking about beetle kill, we're talking about plant trees that are generally already stressed for some reason. And it emits this signal that says, oh, I'm not feeling great. And then the beetles are attracted to that. And so drought, and then add garlic mustard, particularly in areas where we've got 30 acres of 100% ground cover of garlic mustard, these trees are suffering, and it's adding to that stress, making them more susceptible to beetle kill, which of course makes the trees more susceptible to mortality. We have enough dead trees. We're already worried about forest fire. And so it's kind of funny to think of this tiny little herb that somebody brought because it tastes good can change an entire ecosystem.
Okay, so there are efforts. You say there's roughly 700 acres that you know of.
Good point. Right.
That's been documented on the western side, this area. Are they in our backyards?
They are in so many backyards. Okay. If you're in Park City, Pinebrook, Jeremy Ranch, and Summit Park, you probably have it. And if you don't, your neighbor probably has it. And unfortunately, that's probably where it started. And now it's in our open space. And, you know, it's not to come down on folks. People often don't know what they are, but really it's because we didn't recognize it and we didn't get on controlling the weeds in our own yards that they've become a community problem. We talk about noxious weed control as a good neighbor practice, right? I mean, our neighbor is the national forest. Our neighbor are watersheds. And because it is often in people's backyards and not getting controlled, we are having bigger problems in our open spaces.
And you are putting together some programs that people can get involved with to help eliminate, I don't know if eliminate's the word, but help to control.
I want to strongly believe we can eradicate garlic mustard, but I have a hard time accepting that now that I know how widespread it's becoming. But we can get it under control, right? And so by by that, I mean, we can get it to a point where, sure, it has some impacts, but it's not spreading. It's not causing massive impacts to our natural resources. And so we have several programs, and one is just an assistance program. We get funding from the state, and we can help people control garlic mustard and a few other species in their property. Unfortunately, like many programs, we're 30% less funded this year. And so we really have to focus more on controlling in the open space, along streamways, and along trail corridors. So all of those places the seeds could be carried somewhere new will be the places we're looking at. And so our highest priority will be anyone that has houses that are right up against the edge of open space and along streams or near the trails and trailheads. That doesn't mean that we won't help other people. As much as we can do with the money that we have, we will do. But if you sign up for the program, if it's going to flower and we haven't been there, it is your weed. It's your responsibility. You need to pull it. And hopefully we can come and spray for you if you want that in the fall to prevent flowering plants the next year. But we want to reduce herbicide use. So the other program is the garlic mustard games.
Okay.
And this is that countywide program people have been hearing about now for 3 years, where we have volunteers compete. You can be in a team. Your team can be a team of one. And we pull garlic mustard all season long, and our best pullers will be invited to a food truck party at the end of the year, which is always a lot of fun. We have events all season long. Our first one will be June 13th at Copper Moose Farms in partnership with Copper Moose and Savory Kitchen. And at those events, you know, we hang out, we learn about garlic mustard for a bit, and then we pull for about an hour and a half and come back and we weigh our bags, and everybody can enter or give us the information, and we enter it into our dashboard on the Summit CWMA website. So you can track your progress against all the other teams all season long, just on our website.
And we all know Park City likes a good competition. We are a competitive town. We get it. We love it. So this is a way to get involved for a really good cause.
Definitely. And I think, you know, we've got a lot of groups now working with us. Everybody, new people every year. Rotary's doing a Rotary War. So they're looking to compete even just That's with great. Themselves. And we have prizes. We're very lucky to be supported by DeKine, High West. Savory Kitchen, of course, is putting in, like, I think it's a meal for four. All Seasons Adventures gift certificates, Bill White gift certificate. So all sorts of great things that we give away at each of the events. And I think that a lot of it, people don't realize that it actually can be fun to pull garlic mustard, or for those of us who are very stressed out, to zone out and just pull some weeds that easily come out of the ground can be actually very calming.
Okay, real quick, do I need gloves? Because sometimes weeds can be, you know, have irritants or so. You know, can you pull these barehanded, or should you wear gloves?
Generally, I tell everybody you should probably wear gloves whenever you're pulling. Garlic mustard doesn't have anything that you have to worry about, but it loves roses. And so depending on where you're pulling, you probably want the gloves just to make sure that you're not getting thorns.
Okay.
So people can get involved. How do they get involved? What's a website to go to, or how do they sign up?
Just check out summitcwma.org, and also look for signs on the trails. We'll have our pull stations again where there are bags. Just scan the QR code and you can enter your team name and how many pounds that you've pulled right there on the trail side or at our events. Clearly we'll help you enter it there.
Another quick question, because there are people, I just saw this. There are plots around, maybe in Swan, or you said maybe in Round Valley, designated plots that talk about some ongoing experiment. What's happening?
Yeah, so, you know, we've been using herbicide for years. We're always trying to limit the amount we're using. And so now we're starting to look into, are there organic options that are as effective or close to as effective as our synthetic herbicides? And so what you're seeing out there, those colored stakes, are us testing four different organic herbicides, all using different main ingredients. So the active ingredient that will do the killing of the weed. Each of those four have a different active ingredient. And then we'll compare it to the most commonly used synthetic for each species. And so we're looking at the treatment of musk thistle, garlic mustard, and Canada thistle, because we wanted to look at one that's very prevalent here that we spray a lot, one that's a perennial, so it's much harder to kill, And then one that everybody knows because we hate having to bike past musk thistle. And hopefully we'll know by next year some idea of whether or not we could be switching our use to these organic herbicides in certain areas. And so if you see them out there, Round Valley, Swanner, please leave them so that we can learn from them. You'll also maybe see circles of green, lime green flags out there this year.
Oh, yeah.
Please leave those too. What we've done is cut down Phragmites. We're trying to remove the biomass so that we can spray a smaller volume and be more effective at treating Phragmites in the fall when it pulls that herbicide along with the nutrients that it's trying to save down into its root system for the winter. Huh. We'll treat it then. But if we treat those when they have all that dead plant matter around it, it takes a lot more herbicide to get enough cover of the live plant material than if we can remove that dead biomass. So it's one way for us to, one, affect the plant by like hurting it early in the season, two, reduce the amount of herbicide used and be more effective.
All right. Last question. 54 species noxious. Is Kentucky bluegrass part of those noxious species? Sarah, you know, I ask this all the time.
No.
Just say yes or no.
It could be obnoxious. But not noxious.
Good. It's the new it's its own category. Kentucky bluegrass, obnoxious with non-native. So, Sarah Jo Dickin, consultant and plant ecologist, Ecology Bridge, and project manager Summit CWMA. Thank you for joining us this morning, June 13th. Copper Moose website. For people to go to?
SummitCWMA.org, and also free training tomorrow from 9 to noon at the Richens Building in partnership with Summit County, who is also a great resource for noxious weed help.
Fantastic. Well, thank you for joining us this morning. We appreciate you.
Thanks so much for having me.
We'll have you back. You bet. Let's take a break for a couple of underwriters or so, and when we come back, we'll turn our attention to, why not, climate change and its actual potential impacts on the Earth's rotation. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back. Welcome back to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about our relationships with and impacts upon the environment. I'm Chris Cherniak.
And I'm Claire Wiley.
And joining us for the second part of the show is Duncan Agnew. He is a geophysicist with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego. And he's here to talk about... He's here to talk about a really interesting... paper he helped author and present, which makes draws relationship between a warming world and the Earth's rotation. We'll just leave it for there, Duncan. Thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.
Certainly. Good morning.
So I thought let's start with time itself. A quick overview of that, but specifically seconds, right? Because we know that roughly there's 86,400 seconds, plus or minus, each day, or the Earth rotates at that speed or that time element. How is a second measured, and what does the cesium atom have to do with that?
Well, I'm going to back up a bit and say there's two ways to measure the second.
Okay.
The only way that was available until 1955 was pretty much to look at the stars, and when the Earth rotated once, that was a day.
Mm-hmm.
And you divide that into 86,400 seconds. So time was totally the province of astronomers. In 1955, a device called an atomic clock was developed, and it uses atoms of cesium in a vacuum, which vibrate in a particular way. I'd be the first to admit I don't know the details on this.
Mm-hmm.
And so that frequency could be measured very, very precisely. And people already knew that the Earth's rotation rate varied. And so fairly soon after that, the definition of the second changed from being a fraction of the day to being so many oscillations of the cesium atom. It's been defined that way since 1967.
Hmm.
So I don't know what time is, but I do know how time is kept. And we had two different ways of keeping it, one astronomical and one, I guess I could say, quantum mechanical.
Okay. So basically, again, like there's 86,400 of those seconds each day. But absent of the potential impacts of climate change on the Earth's rotational axis, that the Earth has rotated plus or minus over the eons. What are the components or elements that affect the Earth's rotation?
Well, the Earth's rotation has not ever been really been constant.
Right.
Ever since we've had a moon and oceans, the tides raised by the moon have some friction with the Earth, and that slows the Earth down. And that's been going on for the last couple of billion years. And it's still going on, and we can actually measure the effect on the moon with laser ranging to the moon. So that's the, over the long time, that's the dominant effect. On shorter times, the atmosphere is free to rotate differently from the solid Earth, and it does. And so there are very small changes that the Earth's rotation is different by 1 millisecond in the summer versus the winter because of changes in the winds. So that's an example of two things that make the Earth's rotation change. A third, which is a major component of this paper, is the one that's completely obscured to all of us, and that is the fact that we have an atmosphere that moves around, but we also have inside the Earth a giant ball of molten iron called the core, and that molten iron moves around as well. That's what generates the Earth's magnetic field, and just like the atmosphere, it moves in varying ways, and as it changes how fast it rotates on average, the solid Earth has to change to make everything balance.
So
I'm leaving out the climate change part because I'm assuming we'll get to that.
Yes, of course. But what you're saying then is when the Earth's core slows or speeds up, it changes how the Earth is spinning. But in this case, if the Earth's core is slower, then we're actually spinning faster. Is that correct? And explain that in a way that people will understand, not what I said.
This is hard.
Yeah.
I've tried to think of an analogy for it, and I haven't really come up with one, except that I guess if you put a bowl on a Lazy Susan and filled it full of water and started, you know, moving the water around with a spoon and then let go, the water would start to slow down and the Lazy Susan would start to rotate. And that's called a transfer of angular momentum, which is motion in a circle from one thing to another. When we get further along, I have a great analogy for something, but I haven't been able to come up with an easy one for that. But for anyone listening, if you type conservation of angular momentum and look in YouTube, there's lots of nice demonstrations that are much more evocative than anything I could say.
Okay, so we have several components that can go into making the Earth spin faster or slower, but we're really talking about faster or slow in terms of microseconds, correct?
Well, milliseconds.
Milliseconds. Thousands. Okay.
So the thing is, let me back up. We have, if you like, two kinds of definition of time. There's rotational time and atomic time. And so if the Earth measured by atomic time is 1 millisecond, the day is 1 millisecond longer. That's not, doesn't seem like very much, but that's a millisecond every day. At the end of the year, that's a third of a second, which in the timekeeping world is a lot. And so now, as you go on, it gets worse. And so after 10 years, it would be 3 seconds. So even small changes in the rotation rate, because they add up, affect the match between time as we would define it with the Earth and time as we define it with atomic clocks.
And how we're defining time or how we've looked at time in the past has shifted given technology, because weren't we navigating by the stars and how the sun came up, and now it's all different?
Yes. So So as I said, time was defined by the Earth's rotation, which you could only measure by looking out at the stars. And so that was a part of astronomy. And time is also linked to where are you on the Earth, right? I'm in a different time zone than you are, so it's earlier in the morning for me. And so measurements of time were very much important for navigating ships and, in fact, even long-haul aircraft flights well into the 1960s. You would look at the stars, you would look at their position, you would compare it with a clock that you had, and you would figure out where you were. But that depended on the Earth's rotation being synced to your clock. And so that's gone, right? Nobody practices what's called celestial navigation anymore, except as a hobby. Now we still have stuff in the sky that tells us where we are, but that is satellites, and we get radio signals from them.
We're speaking with Duncan Agnew. He's a geophysicist at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. And we're talking about the Earth's rotation, the impacts or elements that affect the Earth's rotation. Now let's turn to climate change. This is an environmental show, and we talk about climate change every week in one form or another. This is a first, though. How is a warming planet potentially or literally impacting the Earth's rotation?
So there are lots of effects from global warming, but the one that is probably, on a show like this, I don't want to say will have the greatest impact, but will certainly has a major impact is melting of ice at the poles. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's up to now, that's mostly been Greenland. The Arctic has gotten significantly warmer, the Antarctic not so much. And so there's a great deal of melting of ice. So you have a lot of water in solid form that's near the pole. It melts, it goes into the ocean and spreads out over the entire Earth. So effectively that water that used to be near the pole is now further away from the pole. And what does this have to do with Earth rotation? Well, now I get to use my favorite analogy, which is if you look at an ice skater who's spinning, she can move her arms out and she will slow down, or she can pull her arms in and speed up. That's right. How skaters get these very high speeds. So let's take the arms out part. That's what's happening with this meltwater. It's moving from near the rotation axis, which is the pole, out away down towards the equator. It's not all at the equator, but it's just further away from the pole. And so any melting of ice at the pole going into the ocean changes the Earth's rotation and slows it down.
So right now, by how much? Do we have a sense of that?
Not a lot.
Okay.
I mean, the different things I described, the tidal friction and core and everything else, this is a relatively small effect so far. It shows up in not, it doesn't actually show up visibly in Earth rotation. It shows up and changes the Earth's gravity field measured by satellite orbits. You could see that a particular component of the Earth's gravity field was changing in a certain way due to past ice ages until about 1990. And then it started to change in other ways, and now it's changing in the opposite direction. And that's clearly due to, melting of ice at the poles, both, again, Greenland, Alaska glaciers, and now Antarctica. So this is changing Earth's rotation, though not by a lot, but it's an effect that's new. The important thing about it is that this is another way of looking at the effect of climate change. We human beings have done something that has caused the entire Earth to change what it does by causing temperature rises, which cause ice melting. And that's pretty astonishing when you stop to think about it.
Is there a way to model out the future impacts? As we know, the poles are melting at a rate that is going to continue for decades. can we get a sense of what that impact will look like with respect to the Earth's rotation?
We can model it. I mean, basically, a huge amount of effort goes into modeling sea level change,
right?
Potential future sea level change, and that's exactly what this causes. This, so we can use those models to say, here's what the effect on rotation will be. And I have to be clear, the effect is not large,
right?
But it's definitely there. And the genesis of this paper that I wrote was realizing that when you allowed for this effect, you realize that you've got a clearer picture. You've subtracted it out from what was observed, and you got a clearer picture of what the core was doing. So it's important for understanding Earth rotation, which turns out to feed into timekeeping, but it's not going to change the Earth's rotation in any way that anybody but people who need very, very precise measurements of Earth rotation will notice.
Now, we have inserted a second before, but we're talking about, and I've heard, I think I've heard the year 2029, we're talking about the possibility of removing a second. So why is this a large deal for us, that 1 second change?
Well, first, let me briefly explain why insert a second.
Yeah.
And that's because there were these two definitions of time, and there was navigators who wanted time to continue to reflect how the Earth rotated, but it was much better, more convenient in a variety of ways to use atomic time. So the time scale that we all use now is atomic seconds that are atomic time, but the Earth gets out of step with that. So if it got more than about a half a second out of step, the rules are, well, we'll add a second or subtract a second. That is, we'll have a minute with 61 seconds in it in order to bring things back into synchrony. And when this system was set up 50 years ago, the Earth was rotating more slowly than atomic time indicated, for complicated reasons I won't get into. And so you had to, once a year or so, insert a second. You had to have a 61-second long minute. Uh-huh. The result I found was, again, after correcting for everything else, including this global warming effect, was that the core has been steadily speeding the Earth up. And that if you extrapolate that forward, you discover that the Earth will be going faster than the atomic clock. And that means by 2029, we'd have to remove a second. Also, in a world that where global warming hadn't happened, the world we probably would like to be living in,
right,
and there wasn't all this ice melting, the negative leap second that would be needed would be about a year away. And that's pretty easy to look at because you have data running up to now. So it's had an effect in terms of postponing the need for a negative leap second. Why is a negative leap second a problem? Mm-hmm. Well, basically because we're all networked together. In 1972, lots of people did celestial navigation, and the internet consisted of, I looked this up, 24 computers. Now you have how many? And they all have to keep the same time or things go wrong. And so you have to get the fact that there's leap second every so often into the computers. And many of them are probably not set up to handle negative leap seconds, because it's never happened before, and nobody actually ever expected that it would. And so there's concern in the timekeeping community about having to, you know, if we have to do this. Again, it's something that was not anticipated would happen, but it looks like it might.
Yeah, I would think that like space agencies or those that are involved in satellite management, they need to pay attention to things like this.
Well, actually, the biggest, there are lots of things you don't think about as needing precise time, but my favorite that I've mentioned when I have these discussions is the fact that in Europe, all financial transactions have to be accurately timed to the nearest thousandth of a second.
Oh.
So actually, trillions of dollars rest on top of very precise timekeeping now.
This is giving me Y2K vibes. Yes. Are we in preps like we were for Y2K?
This is very Y2K-like. Hmm. Okay, it's a program, it's a computer network programming issue that there are a variety of ways to solve, but the problem that people have asked me, what do you think will happen? And I said, I don't know, because the thing that will happen, if something happens that's bad, it'll happen because we haven't thought of it. So it's kind of, and the same was true with Y2K. All you could do was do as much as you could and hope for the best, which turned out to be enough. The other solution to this problem is to simply stop having leap seconds. They were put in 1972 to make people who use celestial navigation happy. That group is gone. There is some resistance to changing this, but there's no reason you couldn't say, well, we'll let the Earth and the atomic clock get further out of sync. We'll still have to make an adjustment, but maybe we'll have to do it like once every 100 years, and we could have plenty of time to prepare for it.
So it's just really interesting because, like I say, we talk about climate change in one form or another almost every week on this show. And usually it's focused on, say, the chemical and biological impacts to the planet associated with a warming world. Now we, like you said, Dung, we literally have creating a physical impact to the planet as we warm it. So we've checked that box.
That's an excellent way to put it.
Yeah. So now we got all three. We've done it. But like you say, again, it's those institutions, I didn't think about it, the financial institutions, say in Europe or elsewhere around the world, that rely on really, really precise time measurements. Those of us in our day in and day out world, not such a big deal.
Correct. Most people, when told about, you know, we have to have leap seconds at all or negative leap seconds, it always gets some play in the newspaper because it's something nobody thinks about. And when you hear about it, you think, well, this is trivial, right? My watch doesn't keep good time. And we actually, because the Earth has been speeding up, we haven't had a leap second since 2016. And so I'd like to say that, you know, you could see this happen on your phone if you were very careful, but it's probably not going to happen anytime soon. Whether we have a negative leap second or a positive one, it's certainly several years away, maybe longer. So I wish I could give a demo. I wish I could promise people a demonstration of this with their cell phones, but I can't.
Well, I hope those responsible at CENTCOM, who are responsible for our nuclear warhead task force, also are paying attention to things like this, because I'm sure there's very precise computer systems that are involved in that too.
Well, as a way of illustrating the what a nuisance leap seconds are, the global positioning system, which is what the military uses, the clocks are set to atomic time, and they're still keeping the atomic time that they were set to in 1980. They ignore leap seconds completely. So the internal timekeeping for GPS is not the timekeeping we all use. The satellites broadcast what the difference is so people can make that, so your phone can make the correction. But any serious timekeeping effort does not include leap seconds, precisely because they're irregular and such a nuisance.
All right. Duncan Agnew, geophysicist with the Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. Duncan, where can people go to read your paper and learn more about your other work?
Well, the paper was published in Nature and is unfortunately behind a paywall.
Right.
There are a couple of kind of not op-ed articles, but sort of pieces about it that were published in the same issue, which I think was April 11th.
Mm-hmm. And is this nature.com? Yeah. What is the website?
It
would be nature.com. Beyond that, while I have a personal website, I will admit that it's not fully up to date.
Okay.
I should certainly put this paper on it.
this will be incentive to do that.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. Well, in the meantime, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us about this really interesting impact that our behavior is having on the planet's rotation, Duncan.
Yep.
Thank you so much for joining us this morning on This Green Earth.